thank you for joining me on the teleclass titled Powerful Presentations. And a special welcome to all of you who have purchased Trainer's Resource for Infection Control. My name is Paul Weber. My colleague, Dr. Dick Zoutman, and I created Trainer's Resource for Infection Control to be of real value and, in fact, practical use to you guys as you build your infection control education program. And when you purchased Trainer's Resource, you became permanent members of the Trainer's Resource user group and thereby have free access to user group benefits like this teleclass. Other user group events like this one will take place at regular intervals, and I hope you'll be able to take advantage of them all. Our faculty today is a lady who knows an awful lot about PowerPoint and who knows an awful lot about infection control. Gail Gilmore is a nurse and an infection control professional. She found that using PowerPoint to help her infection control education program, she really made great strides. However, as she will say, it's not that you use PowerPoint, it's how you use PowerPoint. Gail gave presentations this year at the CHICA conference and at the APIC conference, both dealing with communications and the use of PowerPoint. She gives some very useful information that you can take advantage of right away. So I'll let her get to it. To give the teleclass powerful presentations from the shores of the mighty Lake Superior, it is my honor to present Gail Gilmore. Gail.
Good afternoon. What an introduction. And basically, I always say when people talk about how many letters you have after your name and things like that, it's just a sign of old age. They sort of accumulate after a while if you've been involved in a number of activities or like going to school and those kinds of things. I'm really glad I have the opportunity to do this, and I wish that I could be with you each in person so we could play at making PowerPoints, because I've found that it's a very fun thing to do, something I can keep myself doing even when I'm too tired and things like that. So I hope you get as hooked as I have been on this. We're going to pretty much work right through the handouts that you have, and for those of you that are able, you'll have the PowerPoint in front of you as well, too. And if we have time at the end, we'll come back and play some with the PowerPoint that we have already. As Dick said, I'm from Duluth, Minnesota, and we have sent the PowerPoint back and forth a couple of times, and in that transfer, as often happens if you're transferring PowerPoints from one program to another, things may move. And so I think on that first slide that has the Duluth, Minnesota location on it, the arrow has moved out to central Minnesota, and that's not where Duluth is. It's really on the western and southern tip of Lake Superior, so that's where I am located right now. On the next slide, it has what we hope to cover today. We'll talk a little bit about some needs of adult learners and why PowerPoint fits into the needs of adult learners, and we'll talk about how you prepare a PowerPoint program, some history of how a PowerPoint came to be, and then hopefully by the time we're done, you will be able to work on developing some PowerPoint slides yourself. On the next slide that talks about James Atherton on the top, I'd just like to mention his theory a little bit. There's a couple of unique things about James Atherton. First of all, he's living, which is unusual for a theorist nowadays, it seems like. But I think that his ideas about adult learning are exactly right. He says that if we as adults have to learn something new, that we are much more able to do that than if we have to learn how to change a practice that we already have. And so he calls that additive versus supplantive learning. And so if, for instance, if you folks wanted to learn how to do skydiving, I guess that's the example I often use, that if you had the time to learn how to do that and the energy and were foolhardy enough, or if you had the money to do it, those kinds of things, that we could probably all learn how to skydive if we wanted to and we had the time. So additive learning, given the right resources, is probably something we could all manage fairly easily. And you can think about this, too. If you've taken up something new in your life that you always wanted to do, you probably could figure it out pretty quickly. The problem comes when it's supplantive learning, and so that we have to give up something that we're already very good at and replace it with something else. Maybe right-handed and left-handed is a way to think about it. So if you have been right-handed all your life and now you have to decide that you're going to do everything with your left hand instead, it would be very frustrating for you. It would take you longer to do things. You would be messier at it. It would make you angry. And it would affect multiple other areas of your life, too. So not only things you had to do with your hands, but it would make you angry in other activities, so to speak. Or maybe it wouldn't, but use that as an example anyhow. And when you think about that with your employees related to infection control practices, too, I think that this is going away somewhat as the years have gone by, but some of us older nurses, if there are any of us that can be called older, you know, when we were going through our training, basically isolation practices were all or nothing, that you were either in isolation or you were out of isolation, and you used all the personal protective equipment or you used none of the personal protective equipment. And over the years now in infection control, we've had to shift our thinking to being, you know, levels of precautions and being able to use your mind and think when precautions are appropriate, when you should use what kind of personal protective equipment, et cetera. And that's not been an easy change for some of us. One of the other areas I've been working in more recently is electronic medical records. And it is very difficult for physicians to give up their dictation machines and instead do computer data entry. And there's lots of reasons why that's difficult for them to do. But part of it is they are so good at dictating into a dictaphone that they can do that quickly. They can do something else at the same time while they're doing it. They don't even have to think about it. But when you start stopping that practice and starting a whole new practice, for instance, of using the computer, it's a very hard thing to do. And you need to think about that when you're training your employees as well, too, that supplantive learning is much more difficult. It takes a longer time for people to make those kinds of changes. And so whatever we can do to make that easier for them, and a lot of that is with reinforced learning or with using pictures and diagrams and posters, and, you know, have repetitious type learning activities, that helps us all learn supplantive learning type things as well, too. Well, enough about the theory then. On the next slide, where it talks about absolute PowerPoint, this is from an article that was published in the New Yorker magazine in 2001, and it says that you can hardly go anywhere in life anymore without coming across PowerPoint presentations. And this author was quoted as saying it would be pretentious, like wearing no shoes to a business meeting kind of thing. And I think that you've probably seen more PowerPoint presentations in other areas of your life as well, too. You know, are you using them at church or at the Sunday school classes or those kinds of things? It seems to be permeating all facets of society, which has good sides and bad sides to it as well, too. On the next slide, it talks a little bit about the difference between overheads and PowerPoints, and the difference primarily is how the light source is used. And when you're using overheads, the whatever documents you have, the light goes through that, and so it shows up differently on the screen. However, the second statement on there, reading either off of overheads or off of PowerPoints is not very easy to do in either situation. In both overheads and in PowerPoints, you need to make sure that you have a limited number of words on each of the slides, and we'll talk about that more as well, too. The overheads in the past have been usually an inexpensive process to do because you were able to produce those on your own. Sometimes people were very good at even doing them handwritten. But if you sent them out and had them professionally done, they were often a very expensive process to get well-made overheads done by someone else. And it might take quite a long time in order for you to get those back from the print shop wherever you were having the overheads made, things like that. Slides also was the same problem. It was a slow turnaround time. You often had very good results by using slides, and it was a big business. But in this day and age, we're not able to either take the amount of time to prepare them that far in advance, and also things are changing so rapidly that slides get outdated within weeks after you have slides made, and maybe that's even a long period of time. So using PowerPoint is a wonderful advantage because you can quickly make any kind of changes to them that you want to at all. One of the things to think about is, you know, transparencies often were on the projector upside down or backwards or crooked or those kinds of things. And so sometimes it was a problem that way for people watching them or people laughing at you or being embarrassed of yourself for the way that they turned up on the screen. And sometimes it was a problem getting them in order, that they would get out of order. Well, that kind of thing of being crooked or upside down or out of order won't happen in PowerPoint, so that's one advantage to it. But some people have said that maybe that's one of the problems with PowerPoint as well, too, that they are so well and so professionally done that you don't have any fun or joy of seeing the ones that are backwards, upside down, front to back, etc. And so we've lost the interesting part of the presentation. I hope that's not true, however. Just a titch of history about PowerPoint. And on the next slide, it talks about the presenter. And Bob Gaskins was a Berkeley PhD student in California. And he invented this, so to speak, and had it in the first form and called it presenter. It was could only be used on Macintosh computers, which limited the application somewhat. And to begin with, they were all in only black and white colors. Sometime during the 80s, they had to change the name from presenter because there were trademark issues related to that, and so it became PowerPoint after that. One of the people that worked for Bob Gaskins is named Kathleen Belleville. It's listed on your slide there. And she's the graphic designer that first drew those screen bean characters. And she worked with him at Microsoft when it became Microsoft, or was sold to Microsoft, for about 6 or 7 years and drew screen beans that whole time she was there. And one of the things that she's quoted often as saying is that her artwork is in danger of becoming more famous than the Mona Lisa, and that's what she had talked to her mother about, that at least she'd become rich and famous on something. Anyhow, many screen beans are available to you to use for free. They're available in lots of clip art programs, and there also are purchase programs that are available. If you can go on the internet and find those as well, too. There's just an unlimited supply of them. On the next slide, where it talks about PowerPoint 1, so the first edition, this was a company that Bob Gaskins first founded was sold to Microsoft for $14 million. And they kept on Bob Gaskins and his crew as folks that would continue to work from Microsoft, which was kind of an interesting deal, and they're probably sorry they did that, I guess. They stayed in California, and the headquarters of Microsoft was in Washington State. And so the folks that were in California continued to behave and function in their business life as they had previously, and that included having elaborately staged parties with costumes and caviar and all kinds of things. And so apparently Microsoft started looking at them and decided they'd better get this division of the company under some rein. And so apparently lots of the creativity and fun and foolishness that they had been having was stifled by joining a huge corporate world, like happens with many of us. There were some other applications that were similar to PowerPoint. Harvard Graphics was probably the one that was most well known. I never did figure out how to use that, and I'm glad it sort of died a slow death here. On the next slide, it talks about that they then had more revisions, went to PowerPoint 3 and 4.0, and Microsoft then began seriously promoting their Microsoft Office suite of products, which included Word and Excel and spreadsheets, Excel spreadsheets and database and things like that, including PowerPoint as well, too. There were, again, other products that were still around at that time, but for the most part, they have all faded off, and PowerPoint is by far the dominant company in the market now. PowerPoint 97 has virtually no competition. And basically their only product is electronic presentations and then some online documents as well, too. When they started having these available to the general public, they said that some of their customers had trouble figuring out how to start programs and where to begin programs. And so more or less as a joke within the division, they started putting in some sample programs. And they, as a joke, they called it auto content. And auto content has come to be part of the normal English language now, and everybody uses auto content for the most part. And the idea was that this could be virtually documentation free, which is not true, but it does give you ideas on how to do this, and you can choose that as you open a PowerPoint program. In Office 2000, then, is probably the version that most of you are using right now. As it says on that slide, 30 million PowerPoints are used a day, and 11 billion of them are estimated to be used every year. So it's been an amazingly rapid growth in the presentation industry, so to speak. The next slide, we're starting talking about what you should use and what you should do on the PowerPoint slides. And the first one says about white space. And basically, the only rule with white space is to allow plenty of it. And allowing blank space on there is very similar to what you would do on any poster that you would make. Anytime, you know, folks will notice the words, will be able to focus on the words much better as long as there's white space. And white doesn't have to be white. I mean, it could be yellow or cream or whatever it is. And so in addition to having plenty of white space, if you follow all the rules that we're going to talk about later, that shouldn't be a problem with folks being able to read the documentation. The next slide is on font size. And, of course, it depends a great deal on whether you're looking at the computer screen or if it's being projected for you or if you're looking at the handouts. But the font size is just how big of a font size it is, and it has some examples on there of 72, 36, 24 points. The one neat thing that occurs in PowerPoint is that there is a capital A that's up at the top of your screen whenever you have just a single slide open, and you can increase and decrease the size of the fonts just by clicking up or clicking down. So if you highlight whatever words you want to have larger or smaller, you just click and drag across them, and then either click the larger A or the smaller A, you can make that font size get bigger or smaller. There is an automatic setting when you choose a PowerPoint presentation. You can change that for all the slides if you want to, or you can change it on individual slides as you go to. Probably the thing that you need to think about most is how big is your audience going to be and how far away will your audience be from the screen. If you have a huge auditorium that you're speaking to, or even if it's a small group, but they will be far away from the screen, then you'll probably need to use a larger font size. And I wouldn't skimp on that. You can hardly go wrong on having the font too big. I don't think anyone's ever said, "Oh, I couldn't stand that presentation. The words were written too big." But you'll get lots of comments about, "I couldn't even read what they had on the slides." I mean, that's a pretty common thing. On the next slide, they talk about the font selection and the different kinds of fonts that you can use. And they have some examples there of the Helvetica and the Times and the Arial Narrow. The Helvetica, they are saying, is probably the easiest to read. And either if you're looking at it on a computer screen or if you're looking at it on your handouts, I bet that you would say that on the handouts, the Helvetica is easiest to read as well, too. Again, look at it and see what seems to make the most sense to you and what you can read the easiest yourself. The Times print there, if you'll just kind of squint at the Times print, that's called a font that has a serif. And the serifs are the little things that kind of tie one letter into the next one. So if you'll notice, like on the T of point where it says PT, the T has a little bit of a tail on it. And on the other letters, there's a line across the bottom. Those are called serifs. And the idea is supposed to be that draws your eyes across the line. And often in books, they use types of fonts that have serif on them so that you can draw your eyes across the line. But I think in PowerPoint, it kind of blurs it up, and so you can't read it as well. The last one, which is the Arial Narrow, again, there's just a plain Arial that you can choose as well, too, and that will widen out the letters a little bit and also leave a little bit more space in between the letters. And I think that you'll probably like that print much better than you do with the Narrow. And, you know, once you start looking at this, you'll notice other people's presentations that are easier or harder to read. On the next slide, it talks about the color and the use of different colors. In general, the best thing to use in PowerPoint presentations is light lettering on a dark background. So pretty much you can use that on a rule, especially if you are speaking from in a large auditorium and people are far away. The white lettering or white or light lettering on a dark background is best. And if you're just looking, if you're able to see this in color, the colors that stand out the most here on this particular slide are kind of the opposite of that, but it's the black on yellow, which is often the colors that are used for school buses and traffic signs and things like that, because those letters will stand out so brightly on that. So it depends a little bit on what you're using it for. On the other hand, if you have PowerPoints that you've done light letters on a dark background and then you try to make overheads out of them, it pretty much makes a mess because of having to have that much ink sprayed on the overhead. So in that case, you want to reverse it so you'd have dark letters on the light background. You can just play with this a little bit, but the idea is that it should be something consistent throughout all the PowerPoints. On the next slide that has the colors on there with the owls, the four owls again too, if you're looking at it in black and white, you won't be able to see the difference really, but in this case, the color word is in red and the background is in blue, and so those words do not stick out as brightly as it would be if there was more contrast between the front or the lettering and the background. So again, just play with it and see what makes the most sense to you. The next slide is talking about the color wheel, and I don't consciously think of this when I'm putting together a program, but maybe if it was something drastically important that you had to present to the boss or to somebody important, it might be worthwhile for you to think about it this way. And it talks about the use of primary colors in the slides. And then also on the right-hand side of this slide, it talks about colors that complement each other's, and the complementary colors are more likely to produce some kind of a dynamic effect. So in this case, the complementary ones are pointing between the dark blue and the pale orangey color. So those would be complementary and would be maybe sort of like wearing your red business suit or wearing your power suit would be using these complementary colors. The curved line here are the analogous colors, so they are more closely related to each other on a color wheel, and those would be more harmonious or a unified feeling or something like that. So if you're working on a group project together, that might be something for the colors that you could think about. You can just decide if this is a reasonable thing for you to do or to change, whatever. On the next slide, it talks about the difference between the presenter and the PowerPoint itself. And I just want to make a huge point about that the PowerPoint is not the biggest part of the program. You still are the biggest part of the program as the presenter. So that you need to know exactly what you're going to be talking about and have a lot more background knowledge in the subject than you are able to present even. And don't put everything on the slide, because if everything was written on the slide, they really don't need you at all. And, you know, that said, maybe there are instances where that would be absolutely appropriate, that you should put everything on the slides, and then people can review it for themselves, and they wouldn't need you. But otherwise, I would just put highlights, high points on the slides as you go along. Sometimes if people have trouble with their PowerPoint presentations, they feel like they need to just stop and fix the computer or get something replaced or download it again or whatever it is, which is very distracting as far as I'm concerned. You should be able to just go on and give your topic without your PowerPoint and slides as well, too. And actually, maybe in some instances, that is all for the better, because it makes focus on you as opposed to focusing on the audiovisual material. Let's see. If you have to click on a slide and then make some kind of an apology for it, like, I know you can't read this, or I know this is an eyesore, or if you can't see this from the back, or any of those kinds of words, then the answer is just skip it. On the next slide, either if you're seeing it on the computer or on the handouts, you cannot tell what is going on this chart and graph. And even if the presenter uses their laser pointer and can point to a line and say something like, well, as you can see here, there was a great change in such and such a month or whatever it is, it still is of no value to the audience because they cannot see the comparisons. So if you ever feel like you need to say, oh, I'm sorry, I know this isn't a very good slide, don't include the slide. Just leave it out. On the next slide, after that awful graph, I just want to point out that you can blank the screen. And I think this actually might have been Dick or somebody that pointed this out to me, which I didn't know in advance. If you are in the middle of a PowerPoint presentation and you want people to hear a particular point that you are saying, you can hit the B key on the keyboard. B is for black or B is for blank. And it will blank the screen or black the screen. And so people will notice that, and then they'll pay attention to what you are saying. If for some reason you don't want it to be black and you'd rather it was whited out, you can click on W as well, and that will white out the screen. And then when you want to resume your slide presentation, you can just hit Enter again, and it'll go back to the next slide that you were going to move to. Anyhow, it's kind of a neat idea that you can use for blacking the screen, blanking the screen. It's a very neat program to use if you are adding information on. So if you had, I'm sure that you've all seen where people have the next line of text brought in on a slide, so perhaps you'd get just the heading when you start, and then they blow in the first line of text and the second line of text as they're going through the concepts. You can also do that same kind of thing on graphs and charts. It takes a little bit of time to figure out how to use the graphs and charts, but it's not impossible, and it just requires poking around, as so much of learning anything on the computer is. If you just try it and see if it works or not, and then do it several times in a row so it'll stick in your brain, everybody can do this. The PowerPoint is not a difficult thing to learn, just takes a little bit of practice. The next thing is that use little animation. You know, there are all kinds of fancy things you can do as far as blowing in text or adding sound to adding in text or adding in clip art as well, too. If you are looking at this particular slide on your computer in the slide view, that brain is swinging around from the end of the crane there. And it's interesting for the first few times, but after a number of seconds, it's a boring thing to look at. It's very distracting. So you need to think about before you use clip art that way that has motion to it. But it's useful sometimes and interesting sometimes as well, too. Also, you can move around through your slide program. So we are currently on slide 20 right now, and if we wanted to go back to slide 10, for instance, you can just enter 10, the 1 and the 0, and enter on your keyboard, and it will bring you back to slide number 10. And then if you wanted to go on, you could then type in 21 and hit enter, and it will go back to slide 21. It's a very easy way to move around within your slide presentation, especially if somebody asks you a question that's a few slides ago. It gives you a more professional appearance than using the next and previous, or the N and the P on your keyboard, and then having to go back through multiple other slides to get there. However, it does mean that you need to know where your slides are. So if you know your presentation inside and out, it might be worthwhile to just print off a little thumbnail of each of your slides and number them so that you'll know where you need to go to get back to what slide. It's just a little trick that you might want to practice doing in small groups first and then working on it when you're doing a larger presentation as well, too. On the next slide, then, it talks about do you want some discussion in the presentation that you're doing. If you do, then put the controversy on the slide. And it helps a lot if this is a problem in your facility or in the group. and you know that there's going to be some controversy on something. Let's see, I should have thought of something in advance. But let's say whether you're going to require people to wear gloves on entering the room or just to put on gloves if they're going to do any hands-on care with the patient. Maybe that's too hokey of an example. But if you know that that's going to cause controversy in the group, then put it on the slide and talk about it right up front. It kind of diffuses the situation and puts you in a less adversarial relationship with your group so that folks then know that you know both sides of the issue and that there is not an absolute right or wrong to this, but maybe they'll come to a consensus on it, or maybe even though there is controversy on it in your organization, maybe you've had to decide that this is going to be your policy and procedure anyhow, and until there's more research or something, a rule comes up from your regulating agencies or something like that, this is how we're going to do it. But again, the idea is that you are the one that is the resident expert on this, and so you are sharing that information up front. And the last point on here is about checking compatibility. You need to be real careful about using fancy fonts or fancy techniques and things like that when you are doing your presentations somewhere other than on your own computer or in your own facility. Oftentimes people will have different versions or they won't have the same fancy fonts loaded that you have done your presentation on. And so when you come to look at your presentation, sometimes the words don't even fit on the slides or the sizing is all off, or you end up with words across your clip art or those kinds of things. So I'd be pretty cautious about using extra fancy stuff that might not be available on other computers. And then, of course, always check in advance when you are going to do a presentation. I can't tell you how many times I've been caught in that same thing myself, not doing that and assuming things were right and on, and they are not exactly right. So always check no matter what. Okay, on the next slide, it talks a little bit about design choices. And generally speaking, less is more. And when I did a similar presentation at the CHICA conference, they apparently posted the PowerPoint programs on the internet. And so I heard from a man, I believe in Scotland or something like that, and he wrote and talked to me just about less is more, that he picked that one phrase out of my PowerPoint program and wanted to discuss that. He thought that was a good concept, so of course I pretended I made it up, which I didn't. But anyhow, the idea is that the less you put on your slides, the more people will need to listen and make their own opinions and form their own word pictures in their minds of what you're talking about, et cetera. And it helps them remember it much better as well, too. Don't crowd things onto your slides. If it doesn't fit, divide it into several slides. And often having several slides on a topic adds to their understanding or their notice of it as well, too. The next is about using images, and make sure that you do use some kind of images, because it is always interesting to see the pictures that folks add, and sometimes that's the most interesting part, but in some ways they can be very irritating as well, too. The other thing to notice is even a small little picture on your own computer screen becomes huge when you put it on a projected screen. So you need to think about the size of your pictures that you are using as well, too. And on the other hand, if the picture is what you are trying to show, then it obviously should be large size to begin with anyhow. The other thing, when things get projected onto a larger screen, if the quality is not as good, then the quality gets progressively worse. And we have a picture of that in a little bit here that I'll show you some examples of. But again, it's always good for you to try it in multiple places to see how it's going to look and how it's going to go. And the images are secondary. I think it's very easy for you to notice that what you see here is the cartoon, which maybe isn't all bad because I like the cartoon. But it should not be the most important part of the message. The cartoons really are just PSs to whatever message you're trying to get across. But oftentimes the cartoons that you can on the internet or at various websites or the pictures that you can get from multiple sources are what adds the color to your program. Should add information, should clarify something, and then it should have some clear association. Don't work so hard to include jokes or cartoons so that they don't really fit and you have to stretch it too much to make it fit. By the time you give the presentation, it'll make you uncomfortable as well, too. And the next slide, then, is a small little picture that I'm not sure. I think I got off the internet somewhere. And those of you that are looking at it on the computer screen, the small picture looks pretty good. You know, you can obviously see that there's a nurse with personal protective equipment on, and she might be doing something with an IV line. And just when you decide, oh, that picture's really too small for me to see very well, and by the time you click on it and then use the outside handles to make it larger, then the picture is very fuzzy. And I'm sure that there are genuine technical words for why that is or how you could fix it or what you could do with it. But as far as I'm concerned, it's all magic, and I don't really know why that happens. I will tell you one bizarre little thing. Sometimes if I find a picture on the internet or somewhere that I want to use, and then when I put it in the PowerPoint program and work to enlarge it, and it gets fuzzy like this larger picture is, sometimes if you paste it into a Word document first and then resize it in the Word document, it will not be so fuzzy when you put it in your PowerPoint. Now, my husband, who is sort of a computer guru, would just have a conniption if I was even talking about that, because there must be some scientific reason why that will work or won't work, but just accidentally I've discovered that over the years. So it might be worth a try for you sometimes that you'll get a clearer picture if you go through a Word document first. Where can you find images? Well, if you have PowerPoint and the Microsoft Office suite, you probably have some clip art that's available already on your computer program. There's also clip art online packages that you can get, and some of them are included with the programs as well, too. There are just an untold number of packages that you can purchase, you know, at your local computer supply store or also at the larger Target stores, and practically grocery stores and things like that are selling packages of clip art as well, too. And some of them are very good. Some of them are very difficult to find an image that you are looking for in particular. And pretty much across the board, they are very limited in their medical connotations that would be useful to you, especially in infection control practice. There are some anatomical packages that are very good. So if you needed to have a picture of a gallbladder or things like that, that you could get very good images that way. But often in infection control, we're looking more towards patient care practices. And again, that's not easy to find. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Just want to mention one program. It's called Snagit. And at least in the U.S., I think that's only like about $15 or $20 or something like that. What Snagit does is that it gives you the ability to just choose a small portion of the screen, and that then you can copy and paste that. And it's been very helpful with graphs and charts. If you produce graphs and charts in your infection control practice and you'd like to include them in PowerPoint programs, or if you have, a large picture that's a whole picture of nature or something like that, and all you want to include is this edge of the stream. I don't know why you want to do this. But if you snag it, then all you can choose just the portion of the picture that you want to add to your PowerPoint. It's really a very useful deal, very easy to use. You can always go to the internet and get information easily as well, too. And more and more, I'm not using any particular search engine. I just enter the words I'm looking for. And oftentimes you can find the picture. So if you were looking for a picture of Dr. Semmelweis, I would just enter his name in the Google or whatever, and then you'll find pictures of him. And it's very easy to use those pictures. Just right-click on them and copy, and then go to your PowerPoint presentation and right-click and paste it again, too. I think that right-click is something that we should all get engraved on our glasses or put it on your computer screen somewhere. It works in all kinds of ways. Every time I'm sitting there thinking, oh, I wish I could, the answer usually is right-click. So in general, single-click first, double-click second, and then if all else fails, right-click, and usually you can figure out how to do something there. Another thing is scanners have gotten so much better and are so inexpensive now. So if you would want to scan a picture into your PowerPoint, it is phenomenally easy to do that, and the quality is just amazing, even with the inexpensive varieties. So it functions sort of like a Xerox machine. You just lay the picture on the glass, and then you can scan directly into a PowerPoint. Again, most of the scanning programs have a opportunity to, you can just pick and choose part of the picture. You don't have to use the whole picture. So you can choose which part you would like, and when you choose a small portion of the picture and then put it in your PowerPoint, you can also make that picture larger, and the quality seems to be great. And then probably more of you are using digital cameras now, which, of course, is a great thing to use. If you have someone in your facility that everybody knows and loves, if you can take pictures of them either doing something right or doing something wrong, it adds a great deal to your PowerPoint program, and they're relatively easy to download into your PowerPoint programs as well, too. Also do want to mention the trainer's resource for infection control. And I know at least one person that's listening in said they just recently received their package. This is a program that's available from the Weber Training website that's listed on there. And if you'll go to the next slide as well, too, it has a number of things included in this. And the pictures on both of these slides are from the program as well, too. There are two discs included in the program. One of them is strictly prepared presentations and PowerPoint programs that are already made and available for you to use fully. And like I said, this is wonderful because it is difficult to find images that are specifically related to infection control otherwise. But the PowerPoint programs that are already available and accessible there include hand washing, transmission of diseases, antibiotic-resistant organisms, barriers, standard precautions, airborne droplet and contact precaution, SARS, etc., and I'm sure that they'll continue to produce other PowerPoint programs as well, too. Not only can you use them as they are presented to you on this disc, but there is an option for you to add your own slides as well, too. So included in all of these PowerPoint programs is also something that's labeled as green slide, which is the background that will match the rest of the PowerPoint program. And you can copy that slide and insert it wherever you'd like to within these programs. And if you use the slide view, and those of you that have your computer up in front of you, if you're not familiar with that, down in the lower left-hand corner on most programs anyhow, there's those little icons. And if you hover over them, it'll tell you normal view, outline view, slide view, etc. The one that says slide sorter view, if you click on that, and then if you choose to move a slide anywhere, you can just left-click and pull the slide to a different slot in the program if you'd like to. You can highlight any slide and right-click and copy and paste it somewhere else. So there's just all kinds of options that you can do within those PowerPoint programs. On the second disc within this package is an image library. And image library, the words sound a little scary, but included in the program as well is a pamphlet, and it has a picture, kind of a thumbnail picture of each of the images that is included in the program. And there are 271 images that are included in here. And I'm holding my booklet up to the telephone now so you can all see this booklet, right? But in here are pictures of folks emptying urine bags with or without gloves on, of a child licking a telephone, of emphasis on hand washing related to rings, proper way of putting masks on and off, and other personal protective equipment, some needle disposal, etc. So there are all kinds of great photos that are included in here. The booklet also has some good information in the front about using Adobe Acrobat and how to download your the PowerPoint files. If you gals or folks, maybe there's men here too, are at all like me. As soon as I know how to do something, then I can understand the directions. But if I read the directions, particularly on how to do something on a computer, it doesn't make very much sense to me. But if you show me or if I play around with it, and as soon as I know how to do it, the directions make sense. I just want to tell you that the couple pages of directions here in this booklet, I should have written them. I wish I could claim I wrote them, because they are directions that I can actually understand. So anyhow, that looks like a great resource, especially for infection control folks. We'll go through a few more slides here. The next one is just from the APIC recommendations. When they ask people to present, these are the recommendations that they give, that there should be no more than 6 words down on a slide and no more than 6 words across on a slide. They want 3 slides on each page for note-taking. So if you're printing out handouts for people to use, it should be only 3 on a page. And then they recommend numbering and initialing all pages. I haven't been very good at that. That seems rather redundant to me, but that's what their recommendations are. Next slide, have you seen this? And basically people put everything that they want to say included on the slide. It's not only hard for you to read, but sometimes then the presenter reads it to you directly. And like it says there, sometimes even they turn around and read it off of the screen, so they have their back to the audience. And anyhow, just to reemphasize again, don't put everything you know on a slide, or else there's no need for you to be there at all. Robert Morgan has published some rules for PowerPoint presentations, and his first rule is to never use the PowerPoint backgrounds that are provided. And I had to put never in quotes because I almost always use the PowerPoint backgrounds and choose a different one. There are all kinds of them to choose from, and I think they add to the slide programs, but you can decide for yourself. And it's fairly easy to build your own backgrounds as well, too. Just reemphasize again that less is more, and also a picture is worth more than 1,000 words. So if you find an excellent picture to use, then go ahead and use that. Or if you want to use the trainer's resource for infection control, that pictures that they have are worth more than 1,000 words. Number 4 is make sure that you avoid too many animations so that you don't have too much blowing in onto each slide, or else that you use the clip art that has a lot of movement to it. Avoid the distracting sounds, and especially in an auditorium, the noises that things are flipping in or that trains are whistling and those kinds of things are distracting, and usually people can't figure out where it is that comes from the PowerPoint program. They think it relates to something in their environment. Make sure that you are giving your message in the best way you possibly can. Make sure you're interacting with your audience and creative with whatever you do. And somehow or another, your PowerPoint programs should be unique, that they should be recognizable as you're the one that produced them, etc. And that takes time in order to get to that stage of the game, I'm sure. Number 8 is make sure that you know why you're giving this presentation and what your audience is going to know and needs to know. And is it a small group or a large group that you are giving this presentation to? Make sure you practice to make sure that things work and that you have enough information and not too much information to share in the time that's allotted. And then, I don't know how many times we can say, make sure your equipment is set up and working ahead of time. And if it's not working, it takes an inordinate amount of time in order to get it working. And there are just no end to the ways that things can go wrong. You know, is your computer compatible with the projector that you're using? In some instances, it makes a difference that you need to have the projector turned on first before you turn on your computer. Some cases, it doesn't make any difference. In some cases, you have to do the Shift F7, Control F7, Plain F7, whatever it is, in order to get the presentation both on your computer as well as on the big screen. So it's just a little bit different everywhere you go. It's not perfectly refined yet, so make sure that you are there in plenty of time to get it set up ahead of time. And then, of course, you have to dream up some way that some cartoons do fit in here, and this is called racking my brains. So I'm racking my brains to think of ways that we could help make this more interactive when I can't even hear you guys coughing or sneezing or snoring or anything. But we should especially when we're sharing with our infection control people that have come to a conference or are coming for an educational program, make sure that we have some ways that we can make this interactive with them as well, too. I have already mentioned Snagit. I wanted to mention that for sure, and I did mention pasting pictures into a Word document first. So maybe we'll take a minute now and ask if you folks have any questions or comments or things that you have done that have been unique or been effective in your organization.
Gail, that was an outstanding presentation. I use PowerPoint all the time, but I'm not ashamed to say that I learned quite a lot today. Thank you very much. On slide number 36, how did you paste the CDC banner across the top there?
I just went to the CDC site, so any site that I had open that had the banner across the top, and right-clicked on it. And when you right-click, you can copy. And once you've copied it, then you can just paste it into your PowerPoint or paste it in a Word document. In this case, it seemed to transfer fine by just right-clicking it and copying it into the PowerPoint program. So,
we wanted to know about using the notes component when you're doing PowerPoint presentations.
Do you have your computer up?
Yes.
Okay. And are your icons in the lower left-hand corner, the little icons, normal view, outline view, etc.? If you'll click on the normal view, then on your screen it should be in three sections. And so on the left-hand side is kind of an outline view of the slides that you have done already or the slides you're going to do. And then on the top of the right-hand side is the slide itself.
Uh-huh.
And then down on the lower right-hand side is an empty box or it says, does it say click here to add
yep.
notes or something like that? If you just click there, and start typing, that's your notes.
Okay.
Now, what I often do is if I get information, like from the CDC website, if I'm giving a hepatitis C talk, and they have information on transmission, and I'm going to have a slide on transmission, I will just copy from the CDC site all the information on transmission and paste it into the notes. And then I have all my notes available underneath here, and so I can outline it above on the slide then.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, and then, like, when I gave this talk today, I printed out all my notes pages, and I have it that way in this talk I just did now, and it only prints one on a page, so it's a little wasteful on paper, but I have all my notes all done already.
In terms of intellectual property, and the banners and other things that we click and press and add to our presentations, are there any rules and regulations for that?
You know, I do not know formally what this is, but in my mind, what I have decided is that it's similar to the copyright laws when you copy an article out of a magazine, that you can always make a single copy for yourself, that it's for your own use, that kind of thing. And so when I do that in my PowerPoint programs, I think that that is a comparable use of these materials. And, you know, as long as I'm not selling these PowerPoint programs door-to-door and those kinds of things, that it's an appropriate use. And actually, on some occasions, I have sent emails to people. James Atherton, in slide number 4 in this program, his internet address was listed there, and so I wrote to him and asked him if it was okay if I used his graph or chart on additive versus supplantive learning, and he was very pleased that somebody would use it. I may be sticking my head in the sand, but that's been my philosophy, that as long as I'm using it for single use and not marketing it, that it's okay to do.
I'm calling with regards to if you're using PowerPoint where you actually have quotes from somebody or some journal article or something like that, where do you put how do you put or what font size do you usually put that information in, or should you include that in your PowerPoint presentation if you're actually using some journal article or graph or something like that?
If I am, then I usually put it right on the slide in very tiny print at the bottom. I mean, I think that it's more so that if anybody asks you where you got that, you would know where to find it. If it's a formal presentation, you know, so you're really presenting research, then I include a bibliography at the end. and list the whole citation for any of the research materials that I've quoted. I don't go through them in the PowerPoint, but I have them listed in the PowerPoint, so it's available in their handouts for them.
Thanks to everyone for joining this teleclass today, and thanks very much to Gail Gilmore for a really fantastic presentation. Until we meet again, folks, stay safe. Goodbye.